You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
One thing I really miss doing with my dad on the weekend is the quiz. And when we did the quizzes in the Advertiser and Australian and whatever other paper, we had strict rules. One was no internet use. Second was no encyclopedias. Third was no dictionaries. So it had to be done like that. And because I know you've all got your phones off, I'd like you to indulge me. I'd like to ask a few questions and be the quiz master. Okay? Well, here we go. First of all, name the first female CEO of an AFL club. Well, look, is that an you don't know and think you should know, or is it I don't know and I don't care? That's what I thought it might be. That Dad used to snap out, DKDC. If ever the question related to something that he thought was trivial, like who starred in Dobie Gillis and all that sort of nonsense. Okay, well, you might do better with the next one. Name the first female jockey to win the Melbourne Cup. Oh, good on you. Margaret McCann got it at the back. Now, Margaret McCann, do you know if she claimed to be successful in spite of being a woman or due to being a woman? I don't know either. Okay, next one. Name the first female premier of an Australian state. Okay, do you think Joan Kerner would want us to regard her as a role model, a symbol of the female revolution, or a person in her own right who achieved the success? Okay. You go for C, okay? Yeah. I don't think she'd want to be seen as a symbol of the gender revolution.
Okay then. Well, seriously, Jenny, the reason why many of us are underwhelmed by headlines like the first woman to fly a kite is that the more we promote the idea that a few women in top positions are symbols of the gender revolution, the more we perpetuate the old order that enshrines the idea of competition between men and women.
Yes, and seriously, any person of integrity in a position of power and influence would want to make the most effective contribution they could and perform that role to the best of their ability, with gender being a totally irrelevant factor.
In an ideal world, we would expect people to be appointed in positions based exclusively on the skills and attributes we want in a leader. The focus of a selection committee should be on personal qualities, not gender. The last job held, the old boy network, political allegiances, commercial connections should not count.
Well, a lot of women these days don't want to call themselves feminists, and I think it's largely because they're uncomfortable with this idea of the war between the sexes. A typical assertion is that feminists want to replace a male-dominated culture with a female-dominated one. Well, that actually has never been my perception of feminism, but I don't think people want to throw away the gains of the gender revolution. I think what people are trying to say is they want true equality, and that means cooperation, not competition.
And Didn't Germaine Greer say that a struggle that is not joyous is the wrong struggle?
Well, I can remember there was an energy in that in Women's Lib. It has petered out since some of the successes of that movement 50 years ago. Victories like equal pay, women not having to resign when they married to make way for the breadwinners, these victories were celebrated. But you can't keep on getting excited by the fact that you no longer have to get your penniless younger brother to go guarantor for a loan forever. Advances become the norm. We think it's normal for women to go to work. We think it's normal for men to take a greater interest in being fathers.
And all those were perceived as positives. Other things weren't viewed as positively. For example, women have set a higher standard for acceptable married partnerships than their mothers or their grandmothers dared to do. The divorce rate went up, and this was attributed to Women's Lib, rather than the changes in the law. After all, easier divorce suited nearly everyone when conflict exceeded pleasure in a relationship. Women could turn a deaf ear to the, "You made your bed, now lie in it, you're married, aren't you? Get on with it."
The women's movement also cops the rap for the rise of political correctness. You can't give a girl a compliment anymore. You open a door and you're accused of being sexist instead of polite. Well, I mean, it is true that the gender revolution threw into relief questions about social mores. The movement, it seems to me, has stalled a bit in a morass of petty arguments about language. Chairwoman, chairman, chair, firefighter instead of fireman, bartender instead of barman or barmaid. Mind you, that was just as well. When I was 10, I was quite sure that barmaid was a swear word. And the reason for this was next door we had Neville, who was my age, and when he got really, really, really cross with his younger sister, he called her a bloody barmaid. Well, Leigh Creek was one of those industrial towns that didn't have a normal mayor, it didn't have a hotel. What it had was a canteen. So I had absolutely no idea that barmaid was a job description. None. That aside, there are descriptions that I think make most of us cringe. One of them that makes me cringe is male model or female judge, as if, oh, how can a female be a judge? Or male nurse. They're all kind of a bit cringeworthy, so we've all sort of shifted a bit.
Well, the movement may have stalled, but we haven't got where we need to get. There are more homeless amongst older women, more income inequality. Equal pay for equal work is still a pipe dream. Women scientists have to outperform their male colleagues to gain employment in their fields.
Yes, and recently there have been decreases in the number of women on corporate boards and on the front benches of federal parliament.
So, where do we go from here?
Well, I think we need to look at what drives behavioural change in society, and it's not belief. It just isn't. For example, back in the 60s and 70s, when many of us drove home rather worse for wear after a party, nobody said, drink driving's a really good idea. In fact, everybody would have said drink driving is a bad idea. But the behavioural change about drink driving didn't happen until after the introduction of random breath tests.
And the same thing happened with smoking, didn't it? I mean, legislation came in that prevented smoking at work and in public places. This enabled change on the home front. Smokers started smoking outside rather than indoors, and this has now become part of how we live. How can we apply this to increasing the numbers of women on corporate boards? Did you know that only 9 female CEOs among Australia's top listed 200 companies?
It's a bit of a telling figure. We have to change the environment, according to Hugh Mackay, starting at the top. the attitude change that really counts is the one that comes after behavioural change. Men at the top are addicted to positions of supremacy. No amount of gentle persuasion is going to budge them. And if you look at women at the top, they're essentially no different. They assume the system must be pretty damn good because it selected them. Margaret Thatcher's ascension to the prime ministership in Britain did not aid the cause of women that much. So starting from the top, Mackay suggests we set a goal. A minimum of 40% women, 40% men, and 20% whatever for Parliament. Doesn't mean you have to be a whatever, it just means it can be either, one that doesn't fit the male-female agenda. Hugh Mackay, in his Australia Reimagined, claims that 10 years is all it would take to alter the cultural landscape so radically that gender equality at the top would look and feel normal. And at this point, I'm going to ask Richard to read us a little extract from Hugh Mackay's book, Australia Reimagined.
Given the maturity of this debate and the gross failure of the men in charge to do anything about it, the time has come for the community to insist on change and for governments to respond. We have run out of time for this to be voluntary. Equality can't wait any longer. Targets are a feeble joke. Quotas are essential. The growing chorus of men and women in support of quotas will not be silenced, nor should it be. Once the change has been made in those three key areas, boardrooms, senior public service, and Parliament, we will see the influence of that example spread more widely. Only then will we be able to hear the new harmonies of a society that has embraced the idea that men and women are partners in the same project, not combatants in a war. Quotas are not magic wands. They will accelerate the present culture shift and generate a more dynamic, more urgent approach to gender equality. But even that will not be enough. The real task of ensuring gender equality begins in the home and in the classroom. And we must redouble our efforts to encourage parents and teachers to be more alert to the impressions they create and the inherited biases they might be unconsciously transmitting.
All of us, men and women, need to be so accustomed to seeing women functioning in senior positions that we no longer regard it as exceptional. No one wants to see girls and boys, women and men, treated as if they're identical in all aspects of life. No one would suggest that sex differences across the whole gender spectrum are anything but a source of interest and wonderment as we grow through adolescence and into adulthood. Vive la différence! But in the classroom, the workplace, politics, management, leadership, the time has come to don the gender blindfold.
Well, that's all very well and it sounds good, but how do we get there? I guess we have to tackle some practicalities. For example, childcare. One of my pet peeves is that it's regarded as a women's issue. Well, it isn't. Women are only half the parenting deal. We have to look at the conditions for families and parents, not just mothers and women. And that means affordable and available childcare.
After all, children are our future, aren't they? There's been a lot of effort into preschool and primary schools into contradicting the 1950s gender role stereotyping. Children's stories now portray strong female protagonists.
Like Cinderella. Which is a strong, rude one, though. You can see why that particular story has sort of been tossed out of schools lately. Teachers can be formally reprimanded these days for sexist remarks in class or on the sports field. For example, you throw like a girl, or boys don't cry. And these days, it's the other kids who object to teachers saying stuff like that, not just sensitive parents. It's been a long, slow slog, but it's happened. But there are other things that seem to have gone backwards in the last 20 years, and I am thinking of childcare. The costs are dreadful.
Yes, indeed. I was a mature-age student with an 18-month-old baby. and I wanted to study. I remember having to politic and harangue students to agree to higher union fees in order to accommodate a creche in the university. But the common attitude amongst the students was, "That's got nothing to do with me. I don't have any children."
I think I can remember what your response was, you told me once.
Well, I said to them, "You have sex, don't you? We'll call it a sex tax." And indeed, we did get it up and running. And we were the only free childcare centre across the tertiary board. And some years later, actually, it won a national survey for the best run childcare facility. But more importantly, I got an education.
Yes, that's good. Childcare has re-emerged, though, as a major problem for families because of soaring costs. Nowadays, women are not told it's their job to mind the babies. The goalposts have shifted. Instead, it's, "Look, I'd love you to go to work, but we just can't afford it." That's where we need structural change from the top. The need for the service from ordinary families hasn't produced a workable structure. But if corporations, businesses and government were required to have a gender balance, it would be their role to be part of the solution, not part of the problem in providing childcare.
Well, at least these days, it is more acceptable that men are just as capable as looking after the children. Parenting leave needs to be for all employees, male and female, not just the mothers. Fathers need to take up their right for a day and have a day off, take Johnny to the doctor or whatever, and they also need to take up their paternity leave.
And just to change tack a bit, there are real benefits to gender balance in the workplace. Having been mostly on schooled staffs, which were predominantly female, I really enjoyed my time at the Heights, where there were almost as many men. I think gender equity on committees and in the workplace reduces competition between the same gender people, and it produces much better manners.
But often men take over conversations when we're in mixed company.
You're thinking of dinner parties. I've noticed that. But these sort of situations are a lot easier to manage at work because your conversation takes place in a committee structure and you have those rules about, well, you only speak once on each topic. So the structure actually helps you manage the sharing of airtime, I think.
Good manners in mixed company will include referring to each other respectfully, like, "Oh, just like a typical woman, not on," or, "All men are the same." No, we have to be aware of our own unconscious sexist language.
Yeah, I can recall one from school. The teacher next door would send a kid to find a piece of equipment or something, and he'd come back and say, "I can't find it." And she'd say, "Have you had a look for it, or have you had a boy look for it?" Well, I mean, that's the sort of stuff that's just got to go out. And it's absolutely pervasive in our habits. And I think what we have to realise is that we've got to stop using crappy terms like political correctness. You don't desist from sexist comment because it will offend. You desist from it because it's not fair and it's not bloody true.
Right. So, taking a few words from the Institute for Studies in Global Prosperity, it says, "Our aim cannot be only to open room for women to participate in the affairs of society within the present social order. Rather, women and men must work shoulder to shoulder as they apply spiritual principles to the construction of a new social order characterized by justice, peace, and collective prosperity."
Yes, you can see the Baha'i influence in this piece. I've got another bit from the Institute's paper, and I quote, "The recognition of that essential humanity we all share surely is the starting point for the remaining struggle toward true equality. That struggle will be joyous, but it is not based on acrimony, revenge, or desire to compete, divide, conquer, or win, but only to cooperate in the process of bringing out the best in everyone, encouraging everyone to contribute what they can and refusing to concede that gender has anything to do with that process.
And that brings us to the end of our address. As always, we present our ideas as an offering of Unitarian-inspired thought, not as the last words on the subject. We aim to provoke, not to placate, to start a conversation and not to finish one.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.
And not to finish one.